Lecture 12. Cleisthenes, the real father of democracy?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. We're going to conclude our discussion of Cleisthenes in this lecture by looking at what his division of Attica meant. Then we'll consider other aspects of his legislation before ending with the questions about his motive and whether he also deserves the label father of democracy. Last time, we saw how Cleisthenes divided Attica up and scattered its people among 10 new tribes. The idea was to protect the ordinary people from the oppression of local aristocrats throughout Attica, that is. And it was also to cut down on faction fighting, as we'll go on to talk about in a minute. In tandem with this reform, this redivision of Attica, was his move to change the way the people referred to themselves. The norm up till now was for an Athenian to call himself by his given name and that of his father, what we call the patronymic, from pater meaning father. So, for example, you might have Ned, son of George. Now, Cleisthenes ordered that the patronymic be switched for the demotic. In other words, the town where the person came from. Demotic comes from the word deem, that means town. So now Ned, son of George, would become Ned from Marathon, for example, Marathon being in eastern Attica. This seems an odd change to us. What's Cleisthenes getting at? Well, I think what we have to see in this measure is an attempt to promote social and economic equality, to try to reduce the name power of those with aristocratic backgrounds. The other side of the coin, however, and this is what the Athenian constitution tells us, is the way of masking whether you were an old or a new Athenian citizen. So, Ned from Marathon could be anyone. He might belong to an Athenian family that went back to the Bronze Age. Or he could have moved to Athens from somewhere even outside Attica when Solon was offering citizenship to foreign craftsmen. You just don't know anymore. Calling yourself by your given name and demotic now remains the norm in Athenian society. Occasionally, though, we find men who call themselves by the patronymic, that's the name of the father, and the demotic. So, for example, the great 4th century orator and statesman Demosthenes, whom we will meet much later on in the course, he regularly called himself Demosthenes, son of Demosthenes, from Paeania. Paeania was the deme or town on the other side of Mount Hymettus. But when this happened, in other words, when people called themselves by their demotic and patronymic, they were usually the more aristocratic or politically ambitious men. They wanted people to know their backgrounds because this would help them acquire political influence. It's just like today. If we hear about someone proposing policy or standing for the Senate or something, and he's called Joe Blow, and then we hear about a Kennedy, we know immediately who comes from the better, in inverted commas, family, the Kennedys. The Athenians were no different. So what does Cleisthenes' division of Attic society really mean? Why did he do it? Well, you've probably already cottoned on to why he did it. I gave the game away last lecture, and I also intimated about it a few moments ago. How had he broken down the aristocrats' influence in the areas of Attica? How had he protected the ordinary people from exploitation? Because that's what it was all about. The answer lies in the way he put people from different towns into the same tribes. As a result, people from different parts of Attica, nobles and non-nobles, were merged together via the Tritias into a new and different tribe. That meant people who were being intimidated by aristocrats in the areas of Attica in which they lived, or who were suffering hardship from faction competition, for example, could now appeal to their fellow tribesmen and the tribal assembly for help. They can appeal to people, that is, who were not under the sway of oppressive nobles in one town or in one area, because while they were all members of the same tribe now, they lived in different areas of Attica. Hence, they could champion the grievances of their fellow tribesmen elsewhere without any fear of repression or whatever back home. As I mentioned yesterday, someone who was being hard-pressed, say, in a town in the inland region, could now appeal to fellow tribesmen who might be living in the city region or the coast region, and geographically they were far removed from the problem. They didn't need to worry about oppression at this local level, the level where their fellow tribesman was having a hard time. And so they could help him out. The tribal assembly could help him out. Now, people's loyalties also switched to their tribal assembly. And this is terribly important. This is what really sets apart Cleisthenes' legislation from that of Solon. The aristocrats might well try to dominate the assembly when it came to tribal business. This is the tribal assembly we're talking about. But these aristocrats, in reality, were now only part of the mass of the voters. And non-nobles would always outnumber nobles. So that meant that while our aristocrats might try to throw their weight around in the tribal assembly, and I'm sure they did, human nature being what it is, they would find themselves outnumbered by non-nobles, who might automatically take the opposite stance to what the nobles were taking. More than that, as we said before, these tribal assemblies elected their tribe's representatives to the boule in Athens. Now, if you remember, Cleisthenes had increased the number of the boule to 500, 50 men from each of the 10 new tribes. Although members of the boule still had to be over the age of 30, and although the thetes were still excluded, there was intense competition for this council, the boule. Apart from preparing the agenda of the assembly and its probeutic function of discussing business before assembly meetings and then issuing its resolutions to the assembly, the boule was destined to become one of the most important organs of the developed constitution. It met more frequently than the assembly. It met practically every day. And so it could deal with business far quicker than the assembly. I think, as I've mentioned before, the Attic year was divided into 10, not 12 months as we have. So each Attic month was approximately 6 weeks. The assembly met 4 times a month. So that's about once every 1.5 weeks, give or take. The boule, on the other hand, was meeting practically every day, apart from the festival days and the days of ill omen. So therefore, with meeting more regularly, it attracted a lot more business to it. By means of overseeing various city boards, as the Athenians call them, we might call them departments, for example, Department of Public Works or Department of Light and Power. By means of this overseeing of various city boards, the boule came to control the day-to-day administration of the state. Now, whether Cleisthenes realized the potential of the boule or not, his legislation allowed it to acquire this power and to become composed of a wide section of Attic society. Moreover, and this is even more important, because the towns in the tribes were of different sizes and so had different population figures, as we talked about previously, Cleisthenes assigned the 50 boule members for each tribe among the deems of each tribe by their population. This system is the closest to proportional representation in the ancient Greek world that we come across. Now, I suspect Cleisthenes did realize the boule's potential, since he saw firsthand how it rallied the people in defying Cleomenes and Isagoras in 508. Remember, it was the boule, according to the Athenian constitution, that had encouraged the people to resist Cleomenes and Isagoras. It had led the opposition to them. So the boule was far more of a popular organ, say, than the Areopagus. And so Cleisthenes, realizing this, seeing how it interacted with the people, realizing its potential in the constitution, made it the plum council to be a member of. It was not in the best interests of the man who wanted to serve on the boule to oppress those who lived in his own area, because news of what he was up to would spread to other members. Nor was there any point in would-be candidates to the boule trying to intimidate those who lived in their own areas to vote for them in the election, or indeed to let them stand for the boule, because now the tribe was Attica-wide. Forcing somebody in your hometown to vote for you or even to agree to let you be a candidate was one thing. But what about those who were part of the tribe and they lived all over the place? They were not going to be influenced by this sort of intimidation. But I need to make something clear here, because I keep talking about election to the boule and about how the candidates came from the tribes. Election to the boule was not direct. It was by lot. And let me explain that. In other words, out of a number of candidates who were put forward for the 50 spots on the boule, the 50 were selected randomly by lot. So it was a sort of arbitrary process. It was like putting, we don't know however many number of candidates put themselves forward, 150, 200, who knows? But let's say 150, just for the heck of it. 150 names in a hat and you pull out 50. So there's that arbitrary nature to the actual election. It's not a direct election, it's by lot. But getting yourself named as a candidate was still the tricky part, because you would still need to be approved by your tribe as a candidate for election. Therefore, trying to throw your weight around in an area, trying to intimidate someone to vote for you, it was still going to rebound on you. So Cleisthenes widened the socioeconomic composition of the boule. Non-nobles began to play a role in higher-level state administration. Eventually, there would be state pay for attending and living in Athens for a year to attend a boule, to be a member of the boule. And that, of course, would open up membership to a larger cross-section of society, the ones who might not be able to serve as members of the boule, but now could because of state pay. That was something that came in the developed democracy. But these measures that Cleisthenes implemented, as well as the creation of the deme assemblies, that's the town assemblies, and then the various offices that were needed to manage them effectively, meant that ordinary people now throughout Attica gained experience in administration in the city and outside the city. As I said last time, I don't think it's too far-fetched to see in Cleisthenes' three-tier hierarchy of deme or town assembly, tribal assembly, and then Athenian assembly, the origins of our modern local, state, and federal administration, which all citizens can take part in and not have to live only in state capitals, for example. The Athenian constitution describes Cleisthenes' constitution as more democratic than that of Solon. I mentioned this when we were wrapping up our analysis of Solon. I also expressed surprise that the Athenian constitution doesn't say anything about Solon opening up the archonship to non-nobles or enacting that the assembly will now meet more regularly and that all citizens, noble and non-noble, can attend it. Now we can see why the Athenian constitution has this view. I foreshadowed it in our last lecture on Solon. Cleisthenes took democracy to the masses in a way that Solon didn't. Solon's constitution expected that the Areopagus and the Archons would continue running affairs as before. In time, the composition of Archons and Areopagus would alter as non-nobles got elected to office and then became members of the Areopagus. Nevertheless, Archons and Areopagus were always going to run things with the people having a political voice in the assembly. So Solon's constitution really favoured only those who were able to attend assemblies in Athens. Now, however, Cleisthenes gave these same people the opportunity to participate in a political system in which all citizens, noble and non-noble, were in theory equal and regardless of where they lived in Attica, could take part in some form of state administration. They discussed business that affected them all. They elected their tribal representatives to the boule. Well, they did. Although the actual election was by lot, as I just said, they still vetted the candidates who were allowed to stand for the boule. And they supported their tribe and its members. There's some similarity between the modern-day congressman or senator, who is elected by his or her constituency and represents the best interests of that constituency, but at the same time knows he or she knows that he or she is still dependent on that constituency for its support. This wider role of the people in the democratic process and this talk of proportional representation has led many scholars to agree with the Athenian constitution and to take it that one step further, to call Cleisthenes and not Solon the father of democracy. Well, it's up to you to decide where you stand on this. Again, email me and tell me. I don't mind. Cleisthenes did bring political power to the masses far more than Solon did. We've just been talking about that. The Cleisthenic constitution altered political life in a way that Solon had never foreseen. But could Cleisthenes have done what he did without Solon's legislation? Is not the person who starts a process the seminal mover, the father? Now, the Romans might have got around this. The Romans, I'm sure, would have had no problem calling Cleisthenes the father of democracy, because to them, what was important was not the person who invented the thing, but the person who perfected it. I mean, let's face it, the Romans were just a bunch of plagiarists. Now, that statement really upsets Roman historians. That's why I love saying it. But it's true. I mean, would you want to go out for a meal with a race that invented the arch? And that's about all they can talk about. But everything, historiography, literature, philosophy, drama, all came from Greece. How did they get round this? Well, they tell us how they got round this. The person who invented the thing is not as important as the person who perfected it. So they thought, for example, that Virgil, who wrote the Aeneid, did a better job at writing epic poetry than Homer. It's like comparing apples and oranges. You just can't do that. But this is how the Romans got round it, and this is how some people get around calling Cleisthenes the father of democracy and not Solon. Perhaps we can have two fathers of democracy even. Perhaps Solon and then Cleisthenes. The development of democracy was complicated after all, and we can't expect one man to do it all. But then again, one man didn't do it all. I made the point very clearly, I hope, that Solon started off the process and others followed him. We'll see the same when we deal with the Spartan constitution and a chap called Lycurgus. He started it off and others added things to it. But surely when we use a label like father, we should have only one. I mean, realistically, a child can have more than one father in its life. But biologically, it can have only the one. At least I believe that's the case. Democracy took a long time to mature. And even in 508, where we are now with Cleisthenes, it has a heck of a long way to go. And we'll see how far it has to go and dramatic changes that occur to it when we deal with Ephialtes in the year 462 BC. But if we're trying to get back to the father as being the originator of something, which is what a father technically is, I'll always stick to my guns in calling Solon the father of democracy. I can acknowledge the immense changes that Cleisthenes made to the Solonian constitution, as well as the changes Ephialtes did. But to me, Solon's the dad. Two other innovations of Cleisthenes need to be discussed now. The first was in the military sphere, where Cleisthenes introduced a new office of state. This was called the strategos, or professional general. Now, until this time, the polymarchos archon had been in charge of military affairs. But as I said a few lectures ago, it doesn't follow that someone who was born into the right noble family, that's the Eupatridae, had military competence. Athens's relations with other states, especially Sparta, were deteriorating now. I mean, after all, by 508, the year that we're in at the moment, Sparta had twice invaded Attica, the first time to expel Hippias, the second time to help Isagoras out. Clearly then, professional rather than amateur military experience was crucial in any future conflicts. So the strategia, that's the office of generalship, and it also gives us our word strategy, the strategia had as its prerequisite military experience. And leading on from military experience, the ability to advise on strategy. Now, 10 strategoi, or generals, one general from each tribe, remember the 10 new tribes, 10 strategoi were elected annually to this position. And re-election ad infinitum was possible. Now, this was important, that is, re-election, because if Athens were at war, for example, you would want the same generals running things. You would want a continuity of policy. So our civilian archonships are still annual, but the strategos can be re-elected. Pericles, for example, in the Peloponnesian Wars period, he was elected strategos 15 times. Now, an offshoot of Cleisthenes' introduction of the office of strategos was the creation of other military offices. These included the hipparchos, the cavalry commander, and the taxiarchos, the infantry commander. And again, there was one of each of these from each of the tribes. So ultimately, 10 hipparchoi and 10 taxiarchoi. Now, for some reason, the first strategoi weren't elected until 501, 7 years or so after Cleisthenes' legislation. We don't know why there was this gap, but for some reason, the Athenians felt they didn't need a general until then. The second, or the final innovation I want to talk about, as far as Cleisthenes is concerned, is ostracism. Cleisthenes was believed to have introduced this procedure, that's ostracism, as a constitutional way of expelling would-be tyrants from Athens. So his move then was to protect the democracy. Perhaps he had somebody like Isagoras in mind. We've got to remember how Cleisthenes came to power. At first he was kicked out of Attica. Remember we saw the Spartan influence there. That would make sense to want to introduce a professional office of general for future conflicts with Sparta. Would-be tyrants. Isagoras seemed to want to set himself up at the head of an oligarchy. So rather than rely on the boule and the people in future to try to expel would-be tyrants or oligarchs, let's have a constitutional mechanism to do this. Plus, of course, it would involve the assembly, because this is where ostracisms were held. At a special meeting of the assembly, the people decided whether it wanted to banish someone from Athens for a period of 10 years. This was ostracism. Why was it called this, by the way? Why was ostracism called ostracism? Well, at this assembly, the people were told to write the names of anyone they wanted to get rid of on pieces of pot. Now, you know, if you get a pot and smash it on the ground, you get hundreds of sherds or shards, whatever the pronunciation is. And these bits of pottery were called ostraca. So the people in the assembly were given a piece of ostracon, that's the singular of ostraca. They were given an ostracon, and on it they had to write the name of the person they wanted banished from Athens for 10 years. Then they handed in their ostraca. They were counted, and the one who got the most votes won, so to speak, and had to go into exile for 10 years. He was allowed to return. This was not permanent banishment. His property was not confiscated by the state. His family could carry on living in Athens. He himself had to go into exile for a 10-year period. After that, he could return to Athens, and nobody would make any further moves against him. Unless he was ostracized again, of course. Now, the first ostracism wasn't held until 488, about 20 years after Cleisthenes' legislation. Again, the reason for the gap isn't completely known, and all the Athenian constitution says is that the people were now confident to use this procedure. Now, this has normally been taken to mean that after 490, which is when the Athenians defeated the Persians at the Battle of Marathon, the people's self-confidence was so great that they used this radical measure for the first time. We'll be talking about Marathon as the prelude to the Persian Wars in Lecture 18. It's interesting, by the way, that the first person ostracized, that's in 488, was a chap called Hipparchus, who was a relative of Pisistratus the tyrant, not the son, so it was a different person. And we're told that over the next few years or so, the Athenians just opened the floodgates to ostracisms, and that numerous friends of the tyrants were ostracized, oh, easily for the next 4 or 5 years or so. So once they got used to using the ostracism procedure, they used it all the time. And this became, later on, a very convenient political weapon for getting rid of opponents. I'm going to finish now with a few words of conclusion about Cleisthenes and his legislation and his motives. There's no question that the people benefited thanks to his legislation. But was he a genuine political and social reformer? Or was his legislation a byproduct of his ultimate aim to increase the power of the Alcmaeonidae? That's his own family. Is it really possible that he didn't realize how much his own family could benefit from what he did? I find it significant that it was only when Cleisthenes lost out to Isagoras in the Archon elections of 509, as we talked about in the last lecture, that he took the people into his following. He attached them to his group. Remember that phrase? Now, to me, wouldn't someone who genuinely wanted to give the people a greater say in political affairs, give them more equality, socioeconomic equality, remember the name change, wouldn't that person already have the people in his group before standing for the archonship and be elected to it? It's only when he lost out that he took the people into his group. So to me, that implies that he really didn't care about them before. But once Isagoras beat him, well, he had to come up with something pretty smart to win out over Isagoras. Also, in drawing up his blueprint for Attica, Cleisthenes had carte blanche to distribute people in tribes, especially the rival nobles, where he wanted. It's significant when you look at a map of Attica after Cleisthenes that he never affected the power bases of the Alcmaeonidae. These always remained in and around the city. That meant that the Alcmaeonidae always remained a presence in the Athenian assembly and hence in politics. So local government in rural Attica was one thing. Matters affecting the state made by the assembly in Athens were quite another. The power of the Alcmaeonidae was assured in the city, and that family dominated political life for the next few decades, down to the time of the Battle of Marathon in 490. Now, if this cynical scenario is true, and I think it is, then Cleisthenes was a brilliant man who worked for his own ends and those of his family. The fact that the people as a whole benefited was a secondary factor. Now, it's up to you to decide whether he was a genuine reformer or a con man. And as I said before, it's up to you to decide whether he or Solon should be labelled father of democracy, or whether we should have two fathers of democracy. But whichever way you go, at least now you know the name or names of the person or people who created democracy. We've come a long way from the era of oligarchic rule and the lack of rights for all citizens, not to mention their enslavement at the hands of their fellows. The power of the people is such now that it was able to rise up against a Spartan invasion in 508, able to expel a Spartan king from the Acropolis, and indeed force the Spartans into submission. Given that we've been bringing Sparta more and more into our lectures of late, it's now time to turn to that polis. We can't study the rise of Athenian imperialism in the 5th century, nor indeed Greek history, without knowing more about the history and society that were Sparta. And so in our next lectures, we turn to deal with Sparta, the polis of Laconia. Thank you very much.